Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Stacey Lynn in Washington. Another mass shooting, this time at a shopping mall near Dallas. KRLD radio reporter Alan Skaya is in Allen, Texas.
Seven people were shot and killed here at the Allen Premium Outlets. Collin County Administrative Judge Chris Hill says two more died at the hospital. Seven others were hurt.
My family and I are heartbroken and devastated for the loss of life that we experienced today in our community, and we're angry.
He says the shooter was among the nine who have died, and investigators do not have a motive.
The president will meet with congressional leaders on Tuesday at the White House to discuss how to keep the U.S. from defaulting on its debts. Here's CBS's Nicole Killian.
Clearly, all sides are far apart at this point. The White House continues to insist that it wants a clean debt limit increase without any kind of preconditions. And that's something that Speaker McCarthy is not bringing to the table. His conference passed this wide-ranging bill that would raise the debt limit and shred some $4.5 trillion from federal programs, but that simply goes too far for the president.
A lot of migrants are expected at the southern border this week when Title 42 expires. Reporter Chris Fox is in Austin.
The situation at the border is a very serious one, a very challenging one, and a very difficult one.
Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, reviewing operations along the Texas-Mexico border, says they're prepared to handle what happens after the COVID-era restrictions are lifted, but it won't be easy.
We urge Congress to fix our broken immigration system.
El Paso is setting up mega shelters in preparation. Mayor Oscar Leeser.
We are preparing to go into the schools. We're going to prepare to go into the civic center if necessary.
There are calls for charges to be filed against the man responsible for the chokehold killing of Jordan Neely on a New York subway train. The Reverend Al Sharpton says no charges sets a bad precedent.
A mental issue on a train is not to be sentenced with death.
A California task force calls for billions in reparations for Black residents. Representative Barbara Lee.
Reparations are a tangible route to acknowledging and making amends to the glaring economic and social impacts, generational impacts of slavery.
Did you put on a silly hat while sipping on mint juleps watching the 149th Kentucky Derby yesterday? The call on NBC Sports. Yes, Mage with the win, a come-from-behind win, bringing trainer Gustavo Delgado and jockey Javier Castellano their first garland of roses. This is CBS News.
Find your next great hire with Indeed. Their hiring platform makes it easy to attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/...
News brought to you by Gingras Thompson & Watts, your personal injury attorneys with over 35 years of experience. GTWLawyers.com. They're all in to win.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. The federal infrastructure law has been in effect for a year now. Community leaders around Wisconsin are optimistic about badly needed repairs and improvements. Here's Mike Moen.
At the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, Zach Brewing says so far nearly $3 billion in projects have been announced with funding from the law. Most are transportation related, and Brewing says it's badly needed as many areas have backlogs for priorities like road and bridge repairs.
And so by having a real strong federal partnership in the area of infrastructure helps address some of the backlog.
The law will also provide states funding for clean water infrastructure and expansion of high-speed internet. The plan did have some Republican opposition, but has otherwise been hailed by political analysts as a bipartisan achievement. Despite the significance of the law, some of those analysts say it hasn't stayed on the public's radar, especially during the recent election. But supporters are still getting the word out. Megan Rowe is with Opportunity Wisconsin, which has spent the last year educating communities about the benefits of these projects.
Whether we're spending less on car repairs due to updated roads and bridges, having access to safe drinking water or improved mass transit opportunities, this law is a once-in-a-generation investment in our state's infrastructure and competitiveness.
And as more projects are announced, Rowe says it means additional well-paid union jobs for distressed areas. She says the long-term benefits from various improvements should particularly help rural areas and underserved communities. An interactive online map from the White House shows the projects so far are spread fairly evenly across Wisconsin. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell.
Accidents can be life-changing, no matter how careful you are. But with Gingras Thompson and Wachs, you're not alone. For decades, they've been fighting for the rights of people just like you. They'll let you focus on your recovery while they handle the legal complexities. If you or a loved one has been hurt or killed due to someone else's negligence, contact them now. You may deserve compensation.
All in to win, Gingras Thompson and Wachs, GTWLawyers.com.
Bringing some sanity to the airwaves, the Shaw 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM. You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media. To learn more, go to our website, civicmedia.us.
Listen, baby. Ain't no mountain. And we're back. This is the second hour of Morning Cannolis. Thank you so much for joining me once again in our discussion, our weekly review, our assessment of the major stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. We're spending a lot of time talking once again about things going on in the courts of our land, state courts, federal courts, criminal cases, civil cases, and right before the break, talking in particular about this major case coming out of Georgia and the possibility that the DA there, Fonnie Willis, out of Fulton County, may at some point this month, with respect to an indicting grand jury, receive from that grand jury some charges against people involved, potentially involved, arguably involved in the attempt to undermine the election there in the state of Georgia. There is not yet another significant event that happened this past week in connection with January 6th, and again, all of these in connection with the attempt to overthrow the results of the election on that day. We talked at the top of our first hour about those Proud Boys convictions of just this past week, the Fonnie Willis matters, and then we have this. A Pennsylvania welder who attacked police officers at the Capitol, this again on January 6th, did that with a chair and then chemical spray, sentenced just yesterday in the federal district court in Washington, D.C., to slightly more than 14 years in prison. And that is, yes, indeed, the most severe penalty handed down so far in connection with the events of January 6th of 2021. At the hearing just yesterday, this individual, this defendant named Peter Schwartz, he's 49 years old, joined this growing list of people charged with assaulting the police on that day who have received very, very dramatic, strong sentences. Until now, until yesterday, the longest sentence in this January 6th omnibus prosecution of hundreds of people had been a 10-year term. It was imposed upon a fellow named Thomas Webster. We've talked about him in the past. He's a former New York City police officer found guilty last year of swinging a metal flagpole at an officer in the Capitol. Now, the reason why this sentence imposed upon Peter Schwartz just yesterday is significant, not just because of the dramatic nature, the length of the sentence, but also could presage some longer terms for others to come. We talked already this morning about the Proud Boys and the possibility of literally decades of imprisonment possibly being imposed upon them as those sentences go forward. We know as well that just yesterday, in the connection with the prosecution of the Oath Keepers and its leaders, Stuart Rhodes, again, those two previous trials, seditious conspiracy there, the government is recommending 25 years in prison for Stuart Rhodes, again, the leader of the Oath Keepers militia, convicted of seditious conspiracy back in November, along with one of his lieutenants at that time. That sentencing coming up on May 24th, and we will get a fairly good read from the judge, from the government generally, from the courts generally at that time about how the courts are going to be looking at these folks who have engaged in these horrific instances of violence and, more importantly, arguably, also organized it as well. Schwartz himself, Peter Schwartz, convicted in trial back in December of three counts of assault with a dangerous weapon, one count of interfering with law enforcement officers during a civil disorder, and one count of obstructing the certification of the election. Significantly, prosecutors noted that Schwartz was already on probation, had at least one other case also involving charges of assault, illegal firearms possession, 40 prior convictions over more than 30 years for crimes, including things like assault and threatening officers. Prosecutors had explained to Judge Mehta, who is the presiding, the sentencing judge here, that Schwartz really showed no remorse for his actions. He gave several interviews in which he claimed to be the victim of a biased prosecution. During one of those, Schwartz apparently said that the trial is the biggest sham I've ever seen in my life. Even so, in anticipation of the trial, again, shades of things that have happened with respect to other defendants in this case, counsel gets up, appropriately, right to do this, appropriate under our system, and argues for a lesser sentence. That is counsel for the defendant. He says this: there remain many grifters out there who remain free to continue propagating the great lie that Trump won the election, Donald Trump being among the most prominent. That's coming from the counsel for the defendant, Mr. Schwartz, in this case. Mr. Schwartz is not one of those individuals. He knows he was wrong. That's what his attorney is saying. Schwartz himself offered only a single sentence during the course of this proceeding this past week. He read off a piece of paper. He said this: I do sincerely regret the damage that January 6th has caused to so many people and their lives. And that was his statement. Nothing more. Not a whole lot of remorse there. Judge Mehta, again presiding over this, was pretty much unconvinced, noting that Schwartz had continued to appear on these podcasts after his conviction, during the course of those, insisting that it was police who had attacked him outside the Capitol, and dismissing once again these charges against him as politically motivated. Judge Mehta saying this in the sentencing hearing, he said, I appreciate you saying what you did today, but I don't believe it. Again, sentencing him to the longest sentence to date imposed, slightly more than 14 years in prison, bringing to about 450, more than 1,000 people who've been charged in this case, 450 sentenced to this time, anticipating many more being identified and investigated by the U.S. Department of Justice going ahead in all of this. Lots of things going on in January 6th. Looking forward to more information coming out, not just from the federal government, but also, of course, from Georgia, as all of these investigations proceed to determine what happened not only on January 6th, but who is responsible, and determining, again, based upon evidence to a federal grand jury or grand juries in the state of Georgia and also in Washington, D.C., federal grand juries determining whether or not there is sufficient evidence, probable cause to indict individuals for their involvement in January 6th. Monitoring that, of course, these days going forward in the weeks and months ahead, going to be major, major news if indeed these grand juries return those indictments, as they probably will. We don't know the scope of them. We don't know exactly who will be on the receiving end as defendants of those charging documents, but difficult to imagine that all of this could be happening, including the things we are getting hints at from the filings to date, that there will not be some return of charges, state charges and federal charges as well, related to January 6th. Let's stay in Washington, D.C. for a next series of reports of just this past week, also involving the delivery of justice in America. Let's turn to the Supreme Court, as we have in the past, and alerting you also that during the course of our discussion in this segment and into the next segment, we're also going to be doing something special on this edition of Morning Cannolis, a bit of a quiz for all of you, and the possibility of a prize for one of you who may be interested in some Brewers tickets for the Monday night game. I'll talk about that in just a moment or so, all in connection with our United States Supreme Court. Let's talk about the United States Supreme Court again in Washington, D.C., a significant thing once again happening with respect to the death penalty, which, of course, the Supreme Court, under the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, has ruled is constitutional, finding that it is not cruel and unusual punishment to impose the death penalty if a particular state chooses to do so legislatively and the judicial process results in a determination that the death penalty is appropriate. Lots of discussion about that in America. In Wisconsin, we do not have the death penalty. Places like Florida and Texas do, in fact, have the death penalty, which in part leads to our discussion of a significant event this past week. And this one comes out of Oklahoma, but also from the bench of the United States Supreme Court. Supreme Court, just this past week, grants a stay of execution yesterday to a fellow named Richard Glossip, G-L-O-S-S-I-P, on death row in Oklahoma. And the state's attorney general, a fellow named Gettner Drummond, who's a Republican, told the justices that he agreed that Mr. Glossop's execution should be halted. That, once again, a significant story, not because of partisan politics, but because that's what law enforcement, that's what attorneys general on all sides of the political aisle should do. When the merits of a case require that the prosecution not go forward, in this case, the imposition of the most dramatic thing that a state can do with respect to any of its citizens, any of its residents, which is impose the death penalty, a good and decent and fair and responsible law enforcement officer, in this case, Mr. Drummond, the state's attorney general, comes forward and says, you know what? There have been some mistakes made along the way. That's what you expect of responsible, appropriate law enforcement authorities, including the highest law enforcement officers in states. And so what happens is it determines by the state attorney general that things related to testimony given with respect to a cooperating witness during the course of the trial, some of that testimony was false. And the state's brief in an underlying proceeding said that despite that knowledge that that underlying testimony was false in this trial, the state permitted this defendant, this witness rather, to effectively hide some information about his psychiatric condition and the reason for his prior prescriptions through materially false testimony of the jury. Now, that's very much in the details, very much in the weeds. The upshot of that is the jury was not permitted to hear some things about testimony given in the underlying prosecution that resulted ultimately in the imposition of the death penalty against Mr. Glossop. Things not given to the jury, that is a default. That is a defect in the process of justice being delivered there in Oklahoma. The attorney general comes forward, looks at all this and said, yes, indeed, we need to do what's called confess error. And that, once again, a good thing. We call that confessions of error, and courts do, in fact, normally give those things great weight, especially if it comes from the chief law enforcement officer of the state. So the Supreme Court just this past week says that the stay should, in fact, be imposed, grants that stay, and it will remain in place until the justices themselves decide whether to hear Mr. Glossop's appeal, and if they do, until they decide it. And as is customary in these kinds of things, especially these kinds of applications, the court provided no specific reasoning, doesn't have to, but simply says we're going to stay, we're going to grant this request of the state to stay the execution, go back to the lower courts, determine what has to be done there to straighten out this matter, probably giving Mr. Glossop a second trial where these errors are not committed. No public dissents by the United States Supreme Court in the course of its granting this stay. And Neil Gorsuch, for what it's worth, recused himself from the case, did not say expressly why he did that. The court did the similar thing in another case not too long ago in Texas. A fellow named Arely Escobar gave him a new chance to challenge his conviction in the light of a district attorney's confession of error after the discovery of some flawed DNA evidence there, an appropriate exercise of the rule of law, of justice, of the delivery of justice in America for these defendants facing the death penalty, given some opportunity to correct things happening at the lower courts this past week in Oklahoma, previously in other states in the union. Come back as we talk more about the United States Supreme Court and its particular issues related to ethics for its conduct and the conduct of its members on the bench. I made a vow,
I'll be there when you want me somewhere. Feeling down, anxious, depressed? You are not alone. According to the World Health Organization, approximately 280 million people have depression, but the majority never receive treatment. At WellPoint Care Network, they can help. Their outpatient clinic staff are both qualified and caring, not to mention highly trained in partnering with you on your healing journey. Make an appointment today at wellpointcare.org. They serve all ages, infants, children, and adults. Both in-person and virtual services are available. Learn more at wellpointcare.org.
Real Chili's been serving up mouth-watering goodness to the people of Milwaukee since 1931. Their famous secret award-winning chili recipe is the same as it was back then, and a local treasure. From lunch to dinner to late-night breakfast, Real Chili has you covered. And now you can bring the Real Chili to your next party, tailgate, wedding, or office gathering with their unbeatable catering options. And don't forget about their Real Love Party Packs, perfect for small groups, and pick up from their two convenient locations, downtown Milwaukee and near Marquette University campus. Visit them at realchili.com. That's realchili.com.
Up North News Radio is Wisconsin's new choice for progressive talk about important state issues. From the team that brings you the news through social media, newsletters, and here on the radio. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Join me weekday mornings from 6 to 8 a.m.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Partly cloudy this afternoon with highs around 80. Northerly winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. Chance for scattered storms tonight, 49. Overcast. Isolated thunderstorms again tomorrow. Daytime highs approaching 58. Cloudy skies. Chance for scattered showers Tuesday with highs in the mid-60s. Mainly clear skies Wednesday. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 70 degrees.
The Shaw 101 FM. Your fix for progressive talk. From Muskego to Pewaukee. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
We are back here on Morning Cannolis. Thank you for once again joining me and my terrific producer, Anya, here in the studios of WAUK Radio, broadcast areas of Civic Media. I promised at the start of our program this morning to talk about the United States Supreme Court living up to that promise in this, our second hour of the program, the broadcast this morning. And in particular, also said we're going to do something special today by virtue of the leadership of Civic Media. And that is, we're going to do a little quiz right now in the next segment or so. Yes, related to the United States Supreme Court. We're going to encourage you to call in at 844-967-2789. That number once again, 844-967-2789. I have, by virtue of the largesse of one of our sister stations here, WISS 1100 AM 98.3 FM, I have two tickets for the Milwaukee Brewers Los Angeles Dodgers baseball game this coming Monday, May 8th. It begins at 6:40 on the American Family Field right here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I am prepared right now with Anya here also with me in the studios of WAUK to give those tickets to the caller who can call in and provide to me and to Anya some close approximation to this question. And I'm going to give you the lead up to it and then once again get ready to call in. We've talked about this. I've given you the answer in prior broadcasts. Maybe I'll give you some hints along the way, too, if you don't immediately get callers interested in these Brewer tickets for the Monday night game. We know that the United States Supreme Court has on its docket right now about 60 different cases. And that excludes the kinds of things we just talked about having to do with death row inmates and returning cases for stays of execution. All sorts of other things it does on its so-called quiet or shadow docket without opinions. It's got 60 other matters in various other cases of great importance, things relating to gerrymandering and elections, things related to the legitimacy of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, the Clean Water Act, the authority of the Clean Water Act and the EPA to enforce it, the authority of the Secretary of Homeland Security to enforce our immigration laws. That's on their docket. Intellectual property as well, as I mentioned earlier in the broadcast. We know that they're looking at cases involving everything from Andy Warhol to Jack Daniels, bottled toys, those kinds of things. We know as well they're looking at cases involving the appropriate or inappropriate use of race in terms of a consideration for admissions into our nation's private and public universities. Many, many other cases out there on the docket. And again, beginning in June on this program and in others, certainly around our broadcast areas, a discussion as those cases begin to be the subject of opinions issued by the Supreme Court. So all of that leads to my quiz question that if you answer it approximately correctly or give me some sense that you know, in fact, what the Supreme Court is going to be doing in some of these cases, I'm happy through me and Anya to give you those tickets to the Milwaukee Brewers Los Angeles Dodgers game this coming Monday, May 8th at American Family Field. Starts at 6:40 p.m. Call in at 844-967-2789 to engage Anya and me in this discussion. Here is the inquiry. Engage me in conversation about it. We know that among those 60 cases right now pending before the United States Supreme Court, there are two, only two, that come from our federal circuit here in the Seventh Circuit. Seventh Circuit, as you know well, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana. Those three states are the Seventh Circuit. And the Supreme Court has looked at the decisions of our Court of Appeals. They meet principally, not exclusively, in Chicago. Looked at two of the cases coming out of our Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in recent times. And they have granted certiorari, basically meaning they've called up the lower court docket and said, we're going to take a look at these two cases coming out of the Seventh Circuit. We're going to determine whether or not the decisions made by the Seventh Circuit are proper or not, whether those opinions are subject to review. They are subject to review. Whether that review results in a decision by us as members of the Supreme Court to affirm or to overrule those decisions by the appeals court judges in the Seventh Circuit, in our circuit, in our nation. My all-important question, I'll give you a little bit of hint on the answers to this. What are those two cases about? The two cases pending right now from our circuit, what are those cases about right now before the United States Supreme Court? One of them has to do with health care. There's your hint in one of them. And the other one has to do with grocery stores, healthcare and grocery stores. Those two things, we've talked about them before. Yes, indeed, if you want to go online, you can probably find them fairly quickly. But think about discussions that we've had in the past. One of them involving healthcare, a significant case involving Medicare and Medicaid and its future. The other involving grocery stores and what they have done under something called the False Claims Act. Call in to tell me what you know about those cases. And I'll be fairly liberal, fairly broad in giving you a passing grade and give you those tickets, Anya and I will, for the Monday evening game, Monday, May 8th, Milwaukee Brewers, present record 18-13 against the Los Angeles Dodgers, heading up the National League West. Their record right now, 19-13, should be a good game at American Family Field. Call in at 844-967-2789 anytime in the next half an hour or so, and I'll give you those tickets with some attempt to try to tell me what those cases from the Seventh Circuit pending before the United States Supreme Court are all about. We know, once again, that the Supreme Court is deciding those cases in the coming weeks. We're going to spend some time in future broadcasts talking about those. And so we necessarily talk once again about, yes, the E word, ethics. Ethics in the United States Supreme Court. We know as well as we go into our next break that Congress established for the federal district courts and the appellate courts a standard of ethics way back in 1922. The question is, what about an ethics code for the Supreme Court in 2023? Join us, stay with us for that conversation right after this break. And think about those cases from the Seventh Circuit. Call in to discuss those and other matters with Anya and me right after this break. But it was just my imagination once again running away with me. Tell me just my The Sha 101 FM, Brookfield's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
CBS News Brief. A shooter went on a rampage at an outlet mall near Dallas, Texas. This man was inside a store when he heard shots fired.
I heard the gunshots, and we just all rushed to the back. We were all freaking out. We're like, what's going on? What's going on? And I had to go back to the front and lock the door.
8 were killed. The gunman is dead as well. An increase in migrants trying to cross the southern border is expected when Title 42 expires. Laredo, Texas Mayor Victor Trevino says his city doesn't have the resources to handle it.
If all the numbers of migrants are transferred here like it's planned, then it'll be devastating. That'll be a situation we've never seen before.
Protests in New York City ever since a homeless man was choked to death on a subway train. WCBS-TV's Jennifer Bisram.
More than 100 protesters swarmed the Lexington Avenue 63rd Street subway station in Manhattan, taking over the platform, train, at one point even jumping onto the tracks.
CBS News Brief. I'm Stacey Lynn.
Are record high energy and water costs putting a squeeze on your fixed or limited incomes? With inflation rising at record levels and incomes not keeping pace, you might be one of tens of thousands of Wisconsin residents who are struggling to survive. While you may not ask for it, the Keep Wisconsin Warm Cool Fund and your local energy assistance providers are here to help. No Wisconsin resident should ever have to be without heat, water, or power. For a hand up, apply today and call 1-800-506-5596. That's 800-506-5596. Or visit www.heat.help. That's www.heat.help.
Democracy doesn't have to be boring. Founded by revolutionary German exiles in 1853, the Milwaukee Turners at Turner Hall offer gymnastics, rock climbing, yoga, meaningful forums, training, and countless ways to have fun and matter to Milwaukee. Whether you hang upside down or hang out, they've got you covered. Membership is only $35 a year. Be a part of Milwaukee's past, present, and future. Visit them at MilwaukeeTurners.org. That's MilwaukeeTurners.org. Or find them on Facebook or Instagram.
Real Chili's been serving up mouth-watering goodness to the people of Milwaukee since 1931. Their famous secret award-winning chili recipe is the same as it was back then, and a local treasure. From lunch to dinner to late-night breakfast, Real Chili has you covered. And now you can bring the Real Chili to your next party, tailgate, wedding, or office gathering with their unbeatable catering options. And don't forget about their Real Love Party Packs, perfect for small groups, and pick up from their two convenient locations, downtown Milwaukee and near Marquette University campus. Visit them at realchili.com. That's realchili.com.
When it comes to hair and makeup artistry, there is only one salon that you need, Raven and Blonde. Their stylists are passionate about their work and committed to giving you the best service possible. From precision cuts to perms, balayage to dimensional color service and more, the Raven and Blonde stylists do it all. Book your appointment today at ravenandblonde.com. That's ravenandblonde.com. Raven and Blonde, where hair and makeup artistry meets exceptional service. 157 South First Street, Milwaukee.
Are you an experienced industrial painter, drywall finisher, or want to be? Do you want more than a job, but a high-paying career where your interests are well represented, ensuring a safe work environment? The International Union of Painters and Allied Trades of District Council 7 wants you. Bring your knowledge or ask about paid training. Learn more now. Call Tom Coyne, 262-488-4839, 262-488-4839, or go to the union's website, iupatdc7.com.
We are back here in Morning Cannoli is talking once again about justice, the delivery of it, the aspiration for it in America, and chatting now in our final couple of segments here on Saturday morning about the United States Supreme Court, and in particular the challenges it has been facing as various journalists, including some folks from ProPublica, have been identifying some problems related to Clarence Thomas and arguably other justices of the Supreme Court in not disclosing certain benefits, financial benefits, other things that they have received. Right before the break, I was talking a little bit about the history of this. Congress, way back in 1922, established for all the federal district courts, all the federal appellate courts, a creation of a judicial conference, and along with that, establishment of a code of ethics, mostly composed of rules and regulations for situations in which they are obliged to recuse themselves, take themselves off cases, also for the kinds of things that they should and should not take in terms of salary, money benefits, other things that come to them by virtue of their presence, their notoriety as public figures in America. In 1978, Congress enacted a specific statute requiring financial disclosures of our lower federal court judges, district court judges, the appellate court judges as well, again, based on which the Judicial Conference, which was created in 1922, provided written detailed regulations. And so our lower court judges have these set of rules. They've got this ethics codes out there. And the Supreme Court justices, however, the nine of them, are not subject to that same code. The justices have said in a statement to the Senate Judiciary Committee just last month that they view those rules and regulations, those guidelines under the Judicial Conference as important, but they insisted that they voluntarily follow their substance, but they have not regarded them as constitutionally binding on them. Their statement, among other things, noted the Judicial Conference does not supervise them, which again is right technically, but underscores once again the need for there to be some sort of structure in place so that the ethics can be known, the rules can be known by them and everyone else. The Judicial Conference rules and the 1978 statute are based on these fundamental notions about how judges should operate. And even after a recent clarification about some travel on private jets and to some resorts provided by friends, that coming in the wake of the revelations about Justice Clarence Thomas's receipt of some of those benefits from a Republican donor named Harlan Crow, even in the wake of that, it's clear that some of those rules do not apply to stays at luxurious private properties and no maximum value on how much personal hospitality a wealthy benefactor could lavish, for example, on a justice or a judge. So there's still some significant, not just loopholes, but big holes in some of these ethical guidelines and standards. And the larger issue is that today, in May of 2023, even as we go forward and anticipate the Supreme Court issuing major decisions in these cases, there is not a code of ethics with regard to their particular behavior. All of that, of course, as I indicated already, prompted by these disclosures by ProPublica that with respect to Justice Thomas, that some of the disclosures that he did in fact make, gifts of luxury travel, the sale of the home of the justice's mother to Harlan Crow, and Crow's paying of 2 years of private school tuition for Justice Thomas's great nephew, all of those things coming to light recently, all of those things, again, giving greater rise, greater concern about the need for this. Focus as well just this past week upon news that may or may not also be problematic, that a certain judicial activist diverted some fees to Clarence Thomas's wife, Ginny, paid tens of thousands of dollars to her for some consulting work about a decade ago. And the specifics of that required that her name be left off of some of the confirming paperwork. Now, it's unclear at this point about whether or not that did or did not run afoul of what should be an ethical requirement here. Likewise, we've got some concerns about a particular real estate transaction involving Justice Gorsuch, and that too subject to debate and review and analysis by people out there. During the course of a hearing of just recent days before the Senate Judiciary Committee, led by Illinois Senator Dick Durbin, an awful lot of attempt to paint other justices historically, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer and Antonin Scalia, all people on both sides of the political aisle as having taken lavish gifts and trips and those kinds of things, regardless of whether they're liberal or conservative. And the point of all of that, regardless of how you come down in a particular event, a particular donor gift, travel, payment of tuition, payment of fees by your spouse, all those kinds of things,
underscores the point. The fact that we're debating whether or not it falls within a certain set of rules underscores the problem, which is that there are no rules right now. And that was the point of the hearing of these past couple of weeks. That's why these ethics issues have got to be addressed. The Chief Justice, as you know well, has decided not to appear in response to the invitation of Senator Dick Durbin to talk about this, not focusing exclusively upon Associate Justice Clarence Thomas and Gorsuch and perhaps himself. He also has a wife who has worked with and gotten significant amounts of money. She's a headhunter placing various attorneys. Some of them end up in front of the Supreme Court in firms that have actions and business before the Supreme Court. All of that subject to review and analysis, differences of opinion, all of that raising this issue before the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Chief Justice declining to talk about it and saying instead, as I indicated before, that while we'll follow these general principles, we are not bound by what the Judicial Conference says. We're not bound by what a particular set of rules that do apply to the lower courts. We're not bound by those. Again, the difficulty is, what do you do in this case? Will the legislature, as it is threatening, impose upon the Supreme Court a code of ethics in and of itself? An awful lot of belief for the fact that that does not violate the separation of powers if they do so. Nothing wrong with doing that. They already do all kinds of things. They set the numbers of justices. They plainly pass legislation appropriating and giving the Supreme Court money for its operation. Do many other things related to jurisdictional grants. They describe the courts themselves, the structure of the courts out there. So there's all sorts of ways in which the Congress itself is intermixed with and intertwined with the work of the court, short of course, telling the court how it needs to decide particular cases. So the issue about separation of powers is not, from my perspective, a compelling one. The Congress can do that if they can, in fact, get the necessary votes. The question is, should they? The answer is they should if, in fact, the Supreme Court doesn't do it on their own. That's the advocacy that comes out of this news, even of this past week. That's the advocacy that we continue to hear out there in the public domain from members of Congress, from members of the public who, again, view this situation as untenable, not only because of the ethics aspects of it, but because of the very legitimacy of the court. If the court is indeed going to be making these major decisions about all those things I described before, including voting rights and environmental issues and all the other things related to, yes, intellectual property and race in America, all those kinds of things, the legitimacy of its decision-making has to be premised upon a sense among the American people that it comes from a place of integrity and a place where their votes, their decisions about these cases are not subject to question because of their allegiances directly or through their spouses to other individuals from whom they're getting benefits, trips, money, payments, all kinds of things. They should be impartial, and the appearance of impartiality should also be clear. And that's the point of all of this. Reminding you once again that I'm also in a position, by virtue of the largesse of civic media, to be giving to a helpful caller who may call in to talk with me about a couple of those cases coming out of the Supreme Court. And I've got a caller on the line right now. Mark, you're calling back in. Glad to hear from you once again. Give me your thoughts. Maybe also give me an answer to my question. Give me some sense about whether you know, Mark, what I'm talking about in connection with these Seventh Circuit cases. Glad to hear from you, Mark.
Well, I can't really address those. I'm not familiar with those cases, and I couldn't use the tickets anyway. But my question, you just brought up the important point there, is it's Congress's duty to regulate the court when it comes to this kind of thing, that from my read of the Constitution, because it also says the Constitution based on good behavior.
Yeah.
And for John Roberts to duck the question on ethics there is that they shouldn't be setting their own ethics rules. Similarly here in the state of Wisconsin, where Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce wrote the ethics code for our own Supreme Court, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce frequently has cases come before the Supreme Court who funnels money, helps funnel money to various judicial candidates when they're running for office. I mean, some of them have questionable ethics in the first place. Like, for example, Annette Ziegler, before she could enter the Wisconsin Supreme Court, judged on cases her husband was involved in and did not bother to disclose that to the opposing counsel. when she was looking over those cases, she said, "Well, you know, no real big deal. You know, it is a big deal. There has to be not only the clear evidence of no impartiality, but the appearance of impartiality has to be there. I mean, the appearance of bad behavior is just as bad. It undermines the how people look upon the court as actual, you know, criminal behavior, which I think that Clarence Thomas probably was, because his failure to disclose probably put him into that category. Then, I mean, we have to know what is going on. We have to know who paid off, you know, Justice Kavanaugh's gambling debts. We have to know who's been funneling money to some of these people in the past. I mean, that, and for us to ignore it, to allow Congress to ignore it, is not good for not only the opinion of the court, but our trust in government in itself. Because these people do not believe in government,
I don't think.
I think it's Hamilton's warning, as I've said before, is that there's people out there who are enemies to the national government, any possible shape. And I think these people just want to say, well, see, democracy really doesn't work, so we can tweak the edges here and have something more like they have over in Hungary now, or some of the other democracies that have slid back into authoritarian oligarchic rule. And we have to reject that impulse.
We do.
I mean, we have to call to account.
Absolutely, Mark. And again, great comments here this morning. I'm going to unpack a couple of those and underscore what you have said, which is this is both about disclosure. It's about transparency, right? With respect to the Supreme Court, we only have 9 people on the Supreme Court. We're not talking about the 435 members of Congress, although they also should disclose to us their own financial background, the sources of income, those kinds of things that give us a sense of who they are and how their decisions are made. But for the Supreme Court, we've got 9 of them. And they're making these all important decisions, as you just said, Mark, about all these important cases. And so we need to know simply to ensure that we've got confidence that their decisions are not the product of some inappropriate or even appropriate relationship with an outside source. That's basic transparency. And then you also have the other point of which you just made, Mark, as well, which is the appearance. Even if, let's assume that our justices do have that integrity. They do have the capacity to say, well, yes, indeed, I took a trip. My grandnephew is, in fact, getting his tuition paid by virtue of this person. But I can separate that out, and I can make certain that that consideration does not impact a decision that I have in a case, for example, involving Trammell Crow, which apparently did come before the United States Supreme Court and did come before Justice Thomas a number of years ago, along with his colleagues there. I can separate that out. Well, we can say that, and yes, we can perhaps believe that, but it goes to the appearance of impropriety. And we know that the response to that should be recusal, right? It's the R word. I just talked a moment or so ago about the fact that Justice Gorsuch, for reasons that are not disclosed, he looked at that case involving the death penalty and said, you know what, I shouldn't be involved in that. There's something about my background, not necessarily criminal or scurrilous or inappropriate. I've got some connection to somebody somewhere in that matter that renders it inappropriate for me to be deciding that case. I don't want anybody to think that because of my past involvement, my present association, I was impacted by that. Ketanji Brown Jackson has recused herself from one of these major cases coming up. And that involves, in particular, these cases coming out of Harvard and North Carolina having to do with admissions and the use of race. Why? Because she's got this continuing and past affiliation with Harvard. Recusal, the way to go on all of that. These things can be articulated. They can be described by the Supreme Court. They can be followed. And they do, as Mark, you indicated, affect the integrity of the institution and the reputation that it has among all of us. Stay with us for our final segment. Call in if you have got an idea about those Seventh Circuit cases as we go on and talk about even more matters affecting justice in America.
Yeah. Feeling down, anxious, depressed? You are not alone. According to the World Health Organization, approximately 280 million people have depression, but the majority never receive treatment. At WellPoint Care Network, they can help. Their outpatient clinic staff are both qualified and caring, not to mention highly trained in partnering with you on your healing journey. Make an appointment today at wellpointcare.org. They serve all ages, infants, children, and adults. Both in-person and virtual services are available. Learn more at wellpointcare.org.
Real Chili's been serving up mouth-watering goodness to the people of Milwaukee since 1931. Their famous secret award-winning chili recipe is the same as it was back then, and a local treasure. From lunch to dinner to late-night breakfast, Real Chili has you covered. And now you can bring the Real Chili to your next party, tailgate, wedding, or office gathering with their unbeatable catering options. And don't forget about their Real Love Party Packs, perfect for small groups, and pick up from their two convenient locations, downtown Milwaukee and near Marquette University campus. Visit them at realchili.com. That's realchili.com.
Hey, this is Lindsay Kindert at 540 WAUK The Shaw. At Civic Media, we love our local communities and want to share your stories. Submit your local event and we'll let our listeners know. Email me, Lindsay Kindert, at info@civicmedia.us. That's info@civicmedia.us.
What is dedication?
I think a parent's job is to protect our children, but also prepare them for the world so they become good, kind human beings.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Mainly sunny skies this afternoon with a high of 80. Winds out of the north, 8 to 15 miles an hour. Cloudy tonight, chance for scattered thunderstorms. Lows level off around 49. Isolated thunderstorms likely tomorrow. High temperatures reach up to 58. Cloudy skies, mid-60s Tuesday, with a chance for scattered rain showers, upper 60s Wednesday. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 70 degrees.
The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM, Waukesha's only news talk station.
And we are back for this, our final segment here on Morning Cannolis, our weekly Saturday morning discussion of news in the areas of law, government, and the aspiration for justice in America. It is Saturday, May 6th. Thank you once again for joining me for these past 2 hours. As we go into our last segment here, again, looking for a caller, a listener who knows something about some Seventh Circuit cases, call in. I'll give you those tickets. I'll even give you the answers at this point. If you would like to go and see our Milwaukee Brewers take on the Los Angeles Dodgers this coming Monday, May 8th, it's a 6:40 game time at American Family Field. I got two tickets by virtue of the largesse of Civic Media, which Anya and I will give to you in the next 8 minutes or so if you call in and talk with me about those cases or other matters on your mind in connection with the rule of law in America. Let's move from the Supreme Court down south. Let's talk about Florida, and in particular, this abiding, continuing conflict between the governor there, a fellow named Ron DeSantis, and the Disney Corporation. What do we know about that? We know the conflict between the governor, Ron DeSantis, and Disney started way back in March of last year. It's now been going on for about a year or so. Disney, at that time, through its major leadership, joined other companies in criticizing this fairly contentious state education law that, among other things, prohibited and does prohibit classroom discussion of sexual orientation and gender identity for young students. It's sort of been colloquially called the Don't Say Gay Law. And Governor DeSantis and Republican allies in the Florida legislature immediately started to attack Disney as a woke company when Disney was criticizing this law and began efforts to restrict its long autonomy in the state. It's sort of a position of self-government. Among other things, they zeroed in on a special tax district that was created way back in 1967 that basically turned Disney into its own county, if you will, giving it control over fire protection, for example, and policing and waste management and road maintenance and bond issuance, all kinds of things. And crucially, the planning for real estate development. Lots of real estate down there, right? So in February, just this past year, lawmakers there in Florida responded to this continuing dispute between the governor and legislators and the Disney leadership. They stripped control of the district's 5-member board from Disney and handed it over to the governor.
And the governor then appointed new folks to this board, and they reported to duty on the board shortly after that. The new members of this board, however, were fairly incensed, surprised, and troubled to see when they arrived that the departing board, the pre-existing board, had already approved certain of those developmental agreements, and that effectively limited the new board's power for decades to come. And one of those agreements significantly gave Disney the ability to build 14,000 additional hotel rooms, a fifth theme park, yes, indeed, for those, including many of my friends who are big advocates, big Disney fans, three smaller parks in the area. Another one of those agreements restricts the use of abutting land. I know strip clubs, for interest, for instance. And Disney, of course, already has four theme parks, water parks, 18 hotels, a shopping mall, a 220-acre sports complex. Lots of things going on there. We generally refer to that as Disney World. This dispute goes on. Well, we know that in the wake of all of that, in the wake of the fight, if you will, between new and old board members, the attempt to outmaneuver each other, lawsuits begin to be filed by various parties to this matter. And so, for example, the Disney Corporation itself files a lawsuit claiming that the board, the present board, and the governor files this lawsuit in federal court and claims that they're the victims of a targeted campaign of government retaliation for the Disney position on the so-called Don't Say Gay law. On Monday, the board filed its own lawsuit in response to that first lawsuit. So we've got battling litigation going on there in state court as a part of its effort to avoid these various agreements. Lots of things going on legislatively, lots of things going on in the courts there to be sorted out by the federal and the state courts in that jurisdiction. Well, on Friday, just yesterday, the governor signed another bill into law that gives a board that oversees government services at Disney the ability to void development agreements that have already been approved for the resort. In other words, here's a legislative attempt to try to undo what's already been done. At least for now, the new law is this relatively minor development in this ongoing conflict between the governor and Disney over the potential expansion of the company's very broad, that 25,000-acre theme park near Orlando. And, of course, that is, as I just indicated, because Disney and the board have already been sued. They've sued each other in the context of this dispute over the development options. All those agreements now essentially on hold. Disney's still plainly operating Disney World there in Florida, Disneyland out in California, all the other commercial and artistic operations that Disney is all a part of. All of those now awaiting to be addressed by our judicial system. And it underscores, again, not only the challenges plainly presented by an attempt by the governor to try to influence what has to be viewed as an excellent citizen, a resident of the state of Florida, bringing in huge amounts of revenue into that state. Nonetheless, an attack by the governor based upon Disney's affirmation that the legislation passed by the legislature that limits, as I said, the kinds of things that can be taught to young people as a part of their growth, their development in the state of Florida, attacking that as being a narrow and ultimately very, very myopic way of promoting education. We will see how this plays out. It certainly is the rule of law on display, also showing us all the interaction, of course, between the legislature there, state legislature, the impact that it can have in overruling decisions of a board, the impacts that courts will have. We now have two different pieces of legislation, one in state court, one in federal court, basically challenging the very activities that I've just described, determining who has power and whether or not retaliation can, in fact, form a basis for a judgment. How that plays out in the future, we will see. We'll plainly monitor that, not only as an example of rule of law in action, but also because we know that the Supreme Court, too, coming up in just a few weeks, is going to be issuing another major decision having to do with LGBTQIA rights. This one coming out of Colorado, and matters related to the capacities of a government to require that companies operating within its jurisdiction ensure that everyone, including same-sex couples, have access to commercial services. So as we conclude here, yes, indeed, coming out of the Seventh Circuit, Health and Hopkins Care versus Tulevsky, that's one of those cases. Schuett versus Super Value, that's the grocery store case. Both of those coming out by the United States Supreme Court. No takers for the tickets course of the last hour or so. Maybe in the future we'll get more of those down the road. Certainly more discussion of Tulevsky, of Schuett, and Super Value in our future programs here on Morning Cannolis. Thank you for joining me and Anya this morning. Join us again next week for more discussion about law, government, and the ways in which we pursue justice in these United States of America.
When it comes to hair and makeup artistry, there is only one salon that you need, Raven and Blonde. Their stylists are passionate about their work and committed to giving you the best service possible. From precision cuts to perms, balayage to dimensional color service and more, the Raven and Blonde stylists do it all. Book your appointment today at ravenandblonde.com. That's ravenandblonde.com. Raven and Blonde, where hair and makeup artistry meets exceptional service. 157 South First Street, Milwaukee.
What's for dinner? Burgers?
After last week, no thanks.
Avoiding foods due to fear of diarrhea, gas, bloating, stomach pain, or loose, oily stools? It may not be just stomach issues. It could be EPI, or exocrine pancreatic insufficiency. EPI can cause uncomfortable symptoms because it's a condition where the pancreas doesn't release enough digestive enzymes to break down food. But EPI can...
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.